From NPR and WBUR, I'm Mina Kim.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Iran responded today to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's claims that the country has a secret nuclear weapons program. The Iranians say he's lying. Netanyahu presented his evidence in a flashy display yesterday that's been described as a TED Talk. He said Israel seized thousands of secret nuclear files that prove Iran lied about its nuclear ambitions before the deal was signed in 2015. But the documents focused on Iran's activities before 2003, provided no evidence that Iran violated the 2015 nuclear deal, which President Trump has to decide whether to stay in by May 12th. President Trump said the Netanyahu speech proves he has been 100% right to criticize the Iran nuclear deal, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo also said he believes Netanyahu. The BBC's Tom Bateman is in Jerusalem. Tom, give us a hard fact that Netanyahu presented yesterday in his bid to get President Trump to break the deal. Was there something new that raised alarms?
Although he didn't use the words, I think what he wanted people to take away from it was that this was a smoking gun, that Iran had lied, and not just lied at the time about its nuclear program, but had repeatedly lied right up to and including through the nuclear deal. There seems to be a growing consensus, at least among those former diplomats, those former officials that had anything to do with the nuclear agreement, that there was simply nothing new here, that the presentation didn't offer any intelligence that wasn't in one way or another already known about by the IAEA, the UN's nuclear watchdog, or by Western intelligence agencies. Now, Mr. Netanyahu has been asked about that today, and he's fighting back on that and reiterating that he believes that the point is it shows that Iran simply couldn't be trusted and it didn't come clean when the nuclear agreement was signed.
In fact, he spoke with CNN this morning. Let's listen.
Iran signed NPT. Iran signed all sorts of commitments. Iran said that they don't have this nuclear weapons program, and Iran calls daily for the annihilation of my country.
And Tom Bateman of the BBC, what's the opposing view?
Well, it's been interesting that European leaders, and remember that two of the most significant leaders in Europe, Angela Merkel of Germany and President Macron of France, were at the White House with President Trump last week. They have reiterated their view that they want President Trump to hold on to this deal, either in its current form or in some form of renegotiation. And what we have had from France and from the UK, another signatory to the deal today, is that they believe actually that what Benjamin Netanyahu did was to make the point about why you need a nuclear agreement. And one foreign office minister in the United Kingdom said, well, look, they understand the anxieties of Israelis when it comes to what they see as the threat from Iran. But he said that Mr. Netanyahu, by pointing out the fact that there had been a secret nuclear weapons program, that people believe Iran continued to lie about it, that actually makes the case for the nuclear agreement staying in place. Because he said the fundamental point is not about trust, it is about verification. And so he said that the latest verification in February by the UN's nuclear watchdog showed, according to the watchdog, that Iran was not cheating on the deal.
And you speak of the UN nuclear agency, and they have responded as well. They agree with Netanyahu. These documents were all primarily before 2003, and they said, yes, there was a coordinated nuclear weapons program in place before 2003, but they reiterated they found no credible indications of such work after 2009. But then we also heard from the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. this morning on Morning Edition. And he pointed out the big concern, as you said, people understand the concern, that Iran is half the size of Europe. How can just a few inspectors in a country that has a lot of dark corners, how can they verify?
That is a question that's, of course, best answered by scientists. But you'll remember, perhaps, that President Obama, when he was repeatedly asked this question during the negotiations when the deal was brokered, said simply centrifuges and creating fissile material is not something you can do in a closet, that it takes an enormous amount of hardware, an enormous amount of knowledge, and that verification processes do tend to find out if these things are happening. But there are those who say, well, look, what Mr. Netanyahu didn't do was to expose that there is an ongoing program to build nuclear weapons in Iran. If he had done, according to one official that was looking at this, said it would have been explosive. You know, that would have been the evidence that would bring down the nuclear agreement in flames, but it wasn't there. There are really two sides lobbying the White House ahead of this agreement, ahead of the decision by President Trump in 10 days' time whether or not to stick with the deal. They're largely, you know, the Europeans, Russia and China, who want the deal to remain, and countries in the Middle East, key allies of the US, Israel and Saudi Arabia, who have been vehemently opposed to it.
The BBC's Tom Bateman in Jerusalem watching all of this unfold. Tom, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Voters in Nashville are deciding the fate of a public transit plan today that could change the face of the city. The proposal, named Let's Move Nashville, calls for nearly $5.5 billion in spending for 5 new light rail lines, 19 transit centers, and 4 new rapid bus lines, among other things. It would be the largest civic project in the history of Nashville and would be paid for mainly by an increase in taxes. Joining us is Tony Gonzalez, reporter at WPLN in Nashville. And Tony, groups both for and against the plan have spent a few million dollars combined ahead of today's vote. There have been attacks on social media, claims of misinformation. Why is the battle so heated?
Anytime there's a proposed tax increase, I think there's going to be a debate. So that's not too surprising. Voters don't often get to weigh in on taxes or the chance to vote directly on this type of project. You know, it's a multi-billion dollar price tag. I think some people just see that number and think it's too much. So the debate has been, yes, this would be a lot of money. Is it worth it? There's an argument about whether the transit would be for sort of millennials or would it help senior citizens? Is it too focused on the downtown area versus the rest of the city? So it's not really just for or against. There are some sort of more nuanced arguments, but it certainly has been heated for the last couple months.
Yes. Talk about this unusual divide between pro-transit groups and pro-affordable housing advocates when it comes to the plan. Those two groups are typically on the same side of a lot of issues when it comes to cities. Why are they so divided now?
Yeah, I think politically those groups might be aligned pretty often. But here's what's going on in Nashville. I think if traffic and congestion is one top concern, one of the others is affordable housing. The city's been growing quickly. There definitely has been gentrification. Low-income residents have been displaced or moving to different areas. So folks who are worried about that trend say that this type of spending could be better used on housing, or they just worry that if you're going to, you know, build light rail and encourage more development, that could intensify gentrification. The counter argument is that transit might help low-income people to get around town. The plan also calls for certain amounts of affordable housing along the transit lines. But transit and housing, you know, and thoughts about that are definitely part of the disagreement here.
Nashville is one of the fastest growing cities in the U.S. right now. Isn't this kind of the ideal time to be investing in infrastructure and to build for the future? Is that argument holding any sway?
Well, I think a lot of officials or urban planners would actually say that like 20 years ago would have been the ideal time or even longer ago to kind of get in front of the growth. But yeah, those who want transit and who believe in this plan say that, you know, now is the time to act. The projection is that a million more people will be in this region in the next 25 years, and that most every city that is larger than Nashville right now already has a more robust transit system or maybe already has light rail. So they're arguing that the time to act is now. They're also saying that if this vote fails, there's a chance that it will take several more years before a different plan is put together and taken back to voters. So there is sort of an urgency question in front of people right now.
The city is also a big tourist destination. Would this help or hurt tourism? Hotel and rental car taxes would go up to fund this. But on the other hand, it could potentially make it more appealing to tourists who want to get around the city.
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect description there. I think a lot of people locally think it makes sense that visitors would pay a little more through the hotel and rental car tax to kind of contribute to our service. Tourism is certainly booming here, and I don't think officials see that as a bubble. I mean, there's a giant convention center here, pro sports, music festivals, so they're not really worried about scaring away tourists. They think that's just sort of part of Nashville. And we do know that visitors are often, you know, pretty surprised at how hard it is to get around using the existing bus system, and the new light rail lines would go through the tourism areas. So, there would be a more cost for tourists, but I think the city thinks it's well worth it.
Before I let you go, what's the energy and turnout been like today? Do you have any sense of which way the vote is likely to go?
It's really hard to say how the vote will end up. I think there's been a little bit of polling that maybe suggests that voters are going to reject this transit plan, but that's not known. There is a ton of energy definitely around this vote. Early voting turnout was really high, and today there are some lines at the polls. There are extra efforts being made to get people to the polls, to physically help them, rides to the polls to make sure they vote. So this is certainly an abnormally intense and, just the interest is really high here in the city. And I think even beyond Nashville, people are wondering, will Nashville be the next light rail city?
Tony Gonzalez, reporter at WPLN in Nashville, thank you.
You're welcome.
Shingles is caused by the same virus that causes chickenpox. It strikes adults who've already had chickenpox, and it's painful. Not just the rashes, which can spread all over the body, the face, and legs, but the complications, the debilitating nerve pain, for which there's no effective treatment. But now there's a new vaccine, and doctors are saying even if you've had the Zostavax vaccine, which has been out since 2006, you should get the new one, because Zostavax is only 70% effective. And the older you are, the less effective it is. Over 50, it goes down to 38%. The new vaccine? Well, let's find out about it from Dr. Alex Veman. He specializes in infectious diseases at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Dr. Veman, clarify for us. We know this is the same virus that causes chickenpox, but be clear. The very same one, it lives in your body?
Yes, that's correct. When you get chickenpox as a child, it's a respiratory virus, so you get it kind of like you would get a regular cold. And then after you have your illness, it goes into one of your nerves and lies dormant, so it goes to sleep in one of your nerves. And then when you have stress on your immune system, whether it be an illness, a chemotherapy, getting older, something else, another virus that you get, it can come out along the nerve fibers, usually in one small area of the body, and that's where you get the shingles rash.
You know, people who've had it, know it is just excruciatingly painful. And is anyone who has had chickenpox at risk of getting shingles?
Yes, anyone who's had chickenpox is at risk. The younger population, those under 15 or 18 who received the primary chickenpox vaccine and didn't get chickenpox, those people, when they reach middle to late age, they will be protected because they never had the primary virus. But for all of us who are in our 30s and over, we're always at risk.
Okay. So tell us about the new vaccine. It's called Shingrix. The CDC is recommending it for adults over 50. Why is it so much better than the one that's been out?
One thing about it is that it is a subunit vaccine, so it's not the live virus, and it allows your T cells to maintain control of the virus for longer. The old vaccine didn't work as well in those over 70 who were really at the highest risk to get shingles. This vaccine works much better in that older population.
Well, and when you say they're more at risk, we're reading stats like in people in their 80s, half of people in their 80s will get shingles.
So there is kind of an every year increased risk for shingles. In people over 80, if you had 100 people and you gave them 10 years, about 11 of those people would develop shingles in that 10 years. Yeah. So by the time you add that to the people that are younger that are getting it, you do reach up into, the higher 30, 40, 50%.
Okay, so just to clarify some of the things you've said, because I can see people doing the math or calling up their mother. The vaccine against chickenpox came out in 1995. If you don't remember if you had chickenpox, chances are you did if you didn't have the vaccine. And as you said, that means you're a candidate for shingles and a candidate for this shot, which the CDC is now recommending. Are there downsides to that shot?
So there are a couple downsides. The vaccine is more effective, but it also causes a little bit more pain at the injection site, kind of like the tetanus shot, which we know is a very effective vaccine. So about 2 in 3 people will get pain at the site, kind of that dead arm feeling. And then about 1 in 3 will get some redness there. And then about 1 in 5 will get some swelling of the arm. Usually it lasts for about a day or 3, and then will go away. There haven't been a lot of severe reactions. unless people have had some type of allergy to the components of the vaccine. And since it's a two-injection series where you get one and then a second one 2 months later, they looked and saw that the people getting the second shot didn't have any worse reaction than they did with the first one.
Yeah, and you can, by the way, get a prescription from your doctor and get the shots themselves at your local pharmacy. That's what Jane Brody, the great columnist in the New York Times, did. There might be a copay. You should, you know, check it out. But the costs of not doing it. Talk about, again, how devastating shingles is. I mean, the cost of lost work, mental health.
Right. So shingles itself usually lasts, the pain of it usually lasts for up to a month, 2 to 4 weeks. And then there's a subset of people that will develop postherpetic neuralgia, where they have the nerve pain even though the shingles is gone, as if the shingles is still there. And that can be all the time, that can be flares at different times, and the nerve pain is very hard to treat. We know that people who had chemotherapy or people who had diabetes can get this nerve pain, and our medications that we have for that are not that effective. And the postherpetic neuralgia, that pain after the shingles, can last for months to years and can be a debilitating condition for people when we don't have great treatments for it.
Yeah. So again, consider the shots. Dr. Alex Veman, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, talking about the new shingles vaccine, Shingrix, which is much more effective than the previous one and recommended for all adults over 50. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And now to a mystery. This past weekend, on a hilltop in the West Bank, members of the tiny community of Samaritans, yes, descendants of the Samaritan who stopped to help the traveler when no one else would in the parable in the Bible, the Samaritans who see themselves as the most loyal followers of the Word of God as transmitted to Moses, these Samaritans gathered for a Passover ritual, one they've been marking the same way for millennia. NPR correspondent Daniel Estrin saw a ceremony like this years ago, and it put him on a path to solve a crime, the theft of ancient Samaritan Torahs, believed to contain the law of God as revealed to Moses. Daniel tells the tale in a piece on NPR.org. We'll post it. He joins us now. Daniel, what a story. What drew you?
Well, I first visited the Samaritan community in the West Bank 10 years ago. And it felt like going back in time. The Samaritans say that they descend from the ancient Israelites of the Bible. They live a very biblical life. They slaughtered sheep for Passover this weekend, which comes straight from the Old Testament. They use a unique form of Hebrew in their prayers. And 3 times a year, they hold a sunrise pilgrimage going up to their sacred mountain. I recorded a little bit of one of them that I was at. Take a listen. So these are Samaritans dressed in white. They're walking with their canes up to the peak of their sacred mountain in the West Bank. And it's just really incredible to watch. They practice rituals from thousands of years ago. They're one of the world's oldest and smallest religious communities. There's only 810 of them in the world. Half of them live in Israel and half of them live as Palestinians in the West Bank. And a few years ago, I heard about a theft in their synagogue, and it was a mystery that drew me in.
We'll talk about this because the Samaritans also claim to have some of the most sacred documents. So what was stolen?
2 ancient copies of the Torah, the 5 books of Moses, were stolen in 1995. Somebody broke into the synagogue in the West Bank, the Samaritan synagogue, stole a 14th century scroll, a 15th century codex, a book. These were some of the oldest Torah manuscripts stolen in the Holy Land since the time of the Crusaders. And at the time, in the mid-90s when this happened, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat got involved. He tried to get the Torahs back. Israeli officials investigated. The thieves were demanding millions of dollars in ransom. The Samaritans couldn't afford it, and so the manuscripts vanished for years. Until a few years ago, they resurfaced on the antiquities market, and that's when I began this quest. I shadowed a Samaritan elder and an antiquities dealer in Jerusalem, and they were on the hunt to try to get the manuscripts back.
Well, what happened? And again, we'll direct people to your incredible story, this rabbit hole you went down at NPR.org. But what happened?
Well, you know, I went to London and I went to Amman, the capital of Jordan, to try to find out. One of them was said to have gone to London. It's kind of a shady world, this world of the antiquities trade. These were stolen manuscripts, so they're on the black market. But they're very, very rare manuscripts. They have immense spiritual value to the Samaritans. because the Torah is the center of their identity. They claim that even one of the Torah scrolls that they have in their synagogue is the oldest Torah scroll in the world. These are Torahs that are written in this form of ancient Hebrew. They have this look of authenticity. So they're fascinating not only to Bible scholars, but worth a lot to collectors. And I went on this kind of wild goose chase trying to find where they might be.
Well, and we're going to leave it as a bit of a cliffhanger, but suffice it to say, we would have heard if they'd been found. They haven't been found, but there's a tantalizing hint.
Just a few weeks ago, I discovered that several years ago, a page of the stolen Torah was confiscated at the Jordanian border by Israeli customs officials. And it's just one of the pieces of this puzzle. What I did find in speaking with the Samaritan community is that they have a very long history of selling their own sacred manuscripts several centuries ago, selling their own texts to survive. And so there are a lot of suspicions within the Samaritan community about who might have stolen these texts.
So Daniel, has this been exhilarating for you? Has this been, has it turned into maybe an obsession you wish you didn't have? What's this been like for you to join this hunt?
It has been an obsession. It was something that I learned about 5 years ago, the story of this theft. It took a long time to gain the trust of the Samaritan elder and the antiquities dealer who was on the hunt for them. It was a fascinating quest, and I don't think it's over yet.
Well, to be continued, the NPR's Daniel Estrin. Again, read his piece at npr.org. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
More than 1,700 U.S. service members have had combat-related amputations since military operations began in Iraq and Afghanistan, and more than 80% have lost one or both of their legs. Well, now researchers are testing an app that might help veterans and others with prosthetic legs improve their gait. Paige Flager visited the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Maryland and has more.
Rosemary Salak is about 5 feet tall, and she walks with a slight limp, but she's got a wicked sense of humor about it.
I don't care if somebody notices that I'm limping. It usually turns out to be funny, because they'll be, oh, did you hurt your ankle? I'm like, no. I pull up my pant leg, and they're like, oh, I'm sorry.
Salak lost her left leg above the knee. She's an Army veteran who served 23 years, but she didn't lose her leg on duty. She lost it in a car accident when she came home. She says the adjustment to life with a prosthetic leg was difficult, and she was in a lot of pain, but she thought that was just her new normal.
Whatever physical therapy and things they taught me when I first lost my limb, you know, I was getting by, getting from point A to point B, but not doing it in a way that was good for my body.
She was favoring her healthy leg, and after a few years of walking with an uneven gait, her right knee was hurting so badly that she decided to come to Walter Reed Medical Center. Her physical therapist asked her to join a study of a new app.
Kind of like taking back a physical therapist in your pocket.
Medical professor Bob Gailey says the app is called Reload. He and his team of researchers at the University of Miami School of Medicine and School of Music developed the app. Study participants are given an iPad and sensors to place on their legs, their prosthetics, and their lower backs whenever they walk or exercise. The sensors sync up with the app, which gives feedback on their gait in real time.
It will give you automatic commands to tell you how to improve, just like you were in the physical therapy clinic.
Gailey noticed on trips to Walter Reed that patients were listening to music during physical therapy. So he wanted to tap into that habit by having the music distort when the patient's gait is uneven and when their gait is back on track, so is the music. Or they have the option of just getting verbal cues without music.
These are good steps.
Uneven gait can prevent problems like the pain Rosemary Salak was feeling in her knee. Rehab specialist Paul Pasquina leads the rehabilitation department at the Uniformed Services University in Maryland and at Walter Reed.
Losing one's lower limb and walking on a prosthesis does set you up for having long-term problems.
He says people like Salak are at risk of developing back pain or arthritis in their healthy leg. And if a prosthetic makes a person uncomfortable, that can lead to decreased mobility and exercise, which in turn can cause diabetes, heart problems, or strokes.
So these are the sensors.
Even though Rosemary Salak has been using Reload for only a few months, she says it's made a lot of difference in the pain she was feeling and the way she's walking. She says she personally prefers to walk with the commands and no music.
I tried the music, and the problem I had was it changed my gait, because for me, it kind of put me in the dance mode instead of the walk mode. So I thought, although it's much more enjoyable to listen to the music than it is to hear,
roll over your toe.
Whether she's walking or dancing, Salak says it's a comfort to know she's doing it right. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager.
And Paige's story was produced by the American Homefront Project, which reports on military life and veterans.
Websites that trace family trees are facing a lot of privacy questions after news last week that authorities found the suspected Golden State Killer, Joseph James DeAngelo, through a genealogical site. According to the Contra Costa County District Attorney's Office, authorities found several partial matches between DNA at the crime scenes and DNA on the website GEDmatch. Those partial matches were from DNA of relatives of DeAngelo, and that information helped authorities pinpoint the suspect. So is genetic information on family tree websites fair game for law enforcement? Natalie Ram is assistant professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. She focuses on bioethics. And Professor, this site, GEDmatch, is a database where you can upload a digital copy of your DNA profile. How is that different from a site like 23andMe, where you send a saliva sample?
So a site like 23andMe will both generate the DNA profile and keep it within a sort of walled garden. Folks on 23andMe can only compare their DNA profiles to find, say, missing or unknown relatives with other folks who have also used the services that 23andMe provides. The same is true for other big services like Ancestry DNA and the like. The GEDmatch website, or GEDmatch website, allows individuals to upload their genetic information, which has been generated by a different service, a 23andMe or Ancestry site, and share across services. So it's designed to help facilitate people being able to search a broader swath of potential relatives.
So once you voluntarily put your DNA profile on a site like GEDmatch, can the police legally access the data?
The law surrounding these kinds of searches is murky, but there is not a lot of legal protection for these kinds of databases. So if you voluntarily share information of any kind with any third party, the existing law from the U.S. Supreme Court about the Fourth Amendment and its protection against unreasonable searches and seizures basically says once you voluntarily shared your data, you no longer have an expectation of privacy in that data. And that means that the Fourth Amendment often does not apply to that kind of data. In other contexts, Congress has acted to create statutory protections, right? So we have the Stored Communications Act, which gives certain privacy protections for your emails. But we don't have any sort of analogous law for ordinary genetic data, like the genealogical data at issue in the Golden State Killer investigation. We do have protections in some other settings. So your identifiable health information might be protected under the HIPAA privacy rule. And certain kinds of data used for research purposes can be eligible for other kinds of protections. But generally speaking, your genetic information in a commercial, direct-to-consumer website setting, there isn't a lot of legal protection that's obviously available.
Now, the website GEDmatch released a statement confirming that their data helped police find DeAngelo and saying that it has always been their policy to inform users that the data on the website can be put towards other uses. How much information are people required to receive about how their DNA data will be used?
Each one of these websites has a lengthy terms of service or terms of use and a privacy policy, just like many, many other online services. And generally speaking, courts will assume or presume that you will have read and agreed to those terms of service. And if you drill down into those terms of service, each and every one of these websites, as far as I know, includes a disclaimer that says that that website is authorized or entitled to turn your information over to police or others if required by law. And what's also troubling about this case, in my view, is that the DNA that was searched for partial matches, matches that indicate not that the person who uploaded their profile to the GEDmatch website committed the crime, but that a family relative, a genetic relative of theirs, might have been involved in that crime. And that person, the person who ultimately is identified through the partial match, that person never in any sense really voluntarily shared their DNA with GEDmatch.com.
So you're saying people may be unwittingly putting their children, relatives, siblings out there as potential targets by police or other entities?
Yes. And these kinds of searches, these partial match, these familial searches, this is, one of a handful of instances in which I've heard of police using genealogical databases to conduct a search for relatives. But there are about a dozen states that use their state authorized genetic database, right? The database that includes folks convicted or arrested for crimes. And those databases are now sometimes also used to look for partial matches or familial connections, right? And when police do that, they are also, in some sense, scooping in people who haven't been arrested or convicted of a crime. They just happen to be related to someone who was.
But on the other hand, this case turned out well. They caught the suspected killer. So could using these data help solve more crimes?
Just because something will help us solve more crimes doesn't necessarily mean that we should do it. Now, cracking this case, this is a big win for public safety. There's no doubt about that. But again, just because something helps us solve more crimes doesn't mean that we should do it or that the Constitution allows it, right? The police could solve many more crimes if they could indiscriminately and at their whim search everybody's houses or anybody's house. But the Constitution does not allow that. And it's also worth noting that every state has a law on the books about whose DNA should be subject to routine searches to solve crimes. None of those state laws suggest that ordinary citizens should be in the database. No state has suggested, much less authorized, a universal database. And so using genealogical databases for crime-solving purposes subverts this legislative judgment about who should be subject to this kind of perpetual genetic surveillance.
We tend to think of DNA evidence as pretty foolproof, but has it ever led to the wrong person?
Yes. There are several labs throughout the country that have experienced scandals involving mishandling of genetic evidence. It requires care to ensure that a small amount of genetic data aren't contaminated by the lab technician who's conducting the analysis. And new methods of genetic analysis are now being offered that purport or say that they can generate a profile of the person who committed a crime from as little as one or two cells. That's an extraordinarily small amount of DNA, and it's extraordinarily easy for that DNA to be degraded or compromised or contaminated. And so DNA is no more a silver bullet than other forensic sciences.
There are a lot of people who are listening to this conversation thinking that they are safe. They haven't uploaded DNA to one of these genealogical websites. But are there other ways their DNA could get into some kind of database?
Sure. So if you've ever been to the doctor and you had blood drawn, the leftover blood might be in a genetic database out somewhere being used for research. Now, that sample will have been stripped of certain identifiers, your name, your zip code, those sorts of things. But there's a live debate in the bioethics community and the legal community about whether genetic information can ever truly be de-identified. In addition, more and more individuals are having genetic information incorporated into their medical records. So before I had a child, I had some preconception genetic testing done. And that's now a part of my medical record. And while there are more robust protections for medical data, health-related data, and for research data, there's some open questions about how protected that really is. And again, because you may be implicated by genetic information shared by a relative, even if you haven't uploaded your data, someone in your family might have. And it sounds in the Golden State Killer investigation like the individual whose DNA was uploaded to GenMatch, the family member who provided the first connection, the first crack in this case, right? That person may have been a distant cousin. So we're not just talking about first-order relatives, parents, children, and full siblings. Now we may be talking about much more extensive family trees.
Natalie Ram is an assistant professor of law at the University of Baltimore. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
After 6 weeks of intense courtroom battle, the fate of AT&T's $85 billion merger with Time Warner is now on its way to a decision. The Justice Department, which sued to block the deal, ended arguments yesterday, claiming that the merger would cost consumers millions of dollars a year. The company said the merger would benefit consumers because it would allow Time Warner and AT&T to compete more effectively against the booming tech content producers like Google and Netflix. And this comes as another possible merger hits the headlines between T-Mobile and Sprint. So here to explain, please, is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is executive editor of Recode and host of the podcast Recode Decode. Hi, Kara.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. And first, start with any tea leaves you can read. Did the judge, Richard Leon, give any indication how he's going to rule in this?
No, it's not really clear what he's going to do. And he's got a couple of weeks, 4 or 5 weeks, probably in June before there's any decision. He seems to be tending towards AT&T because this challenge by the Justice Department is highly in question. And, you know, many people think is motivated by Donald Trump's antipathy towards CNN, which is part of this merger.
Well, let's explain that because, again, President Trump said he didn't like the merger when it was first spoken of, and everybody knows he's a sworn enemy of CNN. And one of the things the Department of Justice is asking for is that the two companies sell off some of the branches, and one of them would be CNN.
Yeah, they're asking for a lot of things. What was interesting is the person who is now doing this originally had thought there was no problem with it and then suddenly did. There's all kinds of things hanging off of this. And at the same time, it's a vertical merger, which is things, not a horizontal merger, which is like-to-like Sprint and T-Mobile. And so usually these go through without a lot of scrutiny. What's interesting, another request, Disney's efforts to buy parts of 20th Century Fox, doesn't get any attention, and it's a similar kind of thing, and actually even more concentration of content. It's a horizontal merger. So, and that's his friend, Rupert Murdoch. So it's kind of an interesting situation going on.
It is. And let's back up and remind people, although most know, this is all about the changing landscape of what we watch and how we watch it. And, you know, program producers like Time Warner are looking at this landscape and wondering, will we even have TVs as we know them in the future? So tell us more about that.
Well, you know, there is this political overlay in this particular case, and it's quite severe, actually. But in general, it's part of a trend. The reason AT&T is interested in buying this is that companies like Google and Netflix and Amazon are really being aggressive in the content space and are growing very quickly. They also have distribution means. And how people watch television and the way they do it and the way they pay for it is changing drastically. And they're bringing enormous amounts of money to bear. And so a lot of these companies like AT&T are looking for other lines of business. They're in a very competitive cell business with Verizon and now if this other merger takes place.
Right.
And so they've got to get other things. And so the idea is to do more target advertising using content, not unlike when Comcast bought NBC. It's a similar kind of situation.
Well, but you say there's a lot of political overlay and you are concerned about it. But, you know, play devil's advocate. On the other side, the Justice Department is saying that AT&T could threaten to withhold Time Warner content like the NBA games or like CNN and get more money from rival cable and satellite operators to run that kind of programming. So they're saying that's part of their concern.
Yeah, that's their concern right now. But this is a vertical merger, which is not like to like. And they're not at all saying anything on the others. So that's my reason for the ones that are horizontal mergers with people are more worried about, where one company owns quite a lot of content. And so, you know, all these things are political. And that's definitely a concern if they're going to withhold stuff like that. But that's been going on for years. And I think AT&T Randall Stevens has made some promises in this area of not, you know, I think they're willing to make assurances on those kind of things. But that's not what's at play here, really.
There are so many chess pieces here, and you've been mentioning Rupert Murdoch. And for Time Warner, this merger with AT&T would prevent it from being bought out by the Rupert Murdoch-founded News Corp, which there have been attempts.
Yeah.
You know, and some people are thinking, well, Murdoch's not going to want Fox and CNN under one tent, so he might jettison
CNN. He did at
CNN.
One point.
He did.
Yeah, he did at one point. I mean, he's sort of at the end of his career, and, you know, he's selling off. He's a seller in this Disney deal. Right. And they're going to keep, I guess, Fox News and maybe the Wall Street Journal. I forget. That's in a different corporation. I'm sorry, because they split
that
up. It's
confusing.
He's a seller. He's not a collector of assets anymore. I think most people realize. Well, but it's still confusing. But the issue is, it's the backdrop of technology changing the way we get content, and the technology companies entering the content business.
Yeah. Talk just briefly again about T-Mobile trying to merge mm-hmm. with Sprint.
Right. Well, they're the number three or four. There's two top, obviously, cell companies or mobile companies are AT&T and Verizon. Comcast is getting into it, and Xfinity is getting into it, too. But it's a highly competitive area, and these are the two weaker members, and they're merging. They're trying to merge, actually.
And what does it mean for consumers?
In order to be stronger.
Just briefly.
Lower prices, presumably. But this seems to be a consolidation of power. Everyone's saying lower prices. Yeah. But when you have fewer players, there's going to be the prices stay higher, I mean, in general.
Well, look, it's a game of musical chairs, and we're going to watch it unfold, see who gets a seat. Kara Swisher, executive editor of Recode, host of the podcast Recode Decode. Kara, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Mina Kim. This is Here and Now.